طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was originally hosted by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory by a group of his friends. The program is produced by Despina Mortsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with some news out of Palestine. Usually we look for unique stories out of the West Bank and Gaza, but this week, as I reviewed the news from various Palestinian sources, I was struck once again with the sameness of the reports week after week. They are story after story of the brutality by Israel as it carries out its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. We are almost numb from reading the same reports of military incursions, tear gas, demonstrations, arresting children, shooting dissenters, demolishing homes, and making life miserable for Palestinians who are resisting their occupation and exploitation. Here are some of those news stories from this past week, lest we forget what life is like day in and day out for the residents of the West Bank and Gaza. Wednesday, Israeli forces opened gunfire on Palestinian borderline farmlands to the east of Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. Wafa correspondent reported that forces deployed and stationed in military watchtowers along the border indiscriminately opened fire on the borderline farmlands, forcing farmers who were tending to their crops to flee. No casualties were reported on the cross-border attack that constitutes a flagrant violation of the ceasefire deal that ended the latest deadly Israeli onslaught on the war-torn coastal enclave. Israeli forces routinely open fire on Palestinian farmers and other civilians if they approach large tracts of borderline land that the Israeli forces have deemed off-limits to Palestinians, as well as on fishing boats sailing within the 6 nautical mile zone. The buffer zone extends between 500 meters and 1,500 meters into the strip, effectively turning local farms into no-go zones. According to the UN, 17% of Gaza's total land area and 35% of its agricultural land lie within the buffer zone as of 2010, directly affecting the lives and livelihoods of more than 100,000 Gaza residents. Israel and the Palestinian factions inked a ceasefire deal on August 26th, ending the latest deadly Israeli onslaught on Gaza that claimed the lives of over 2,200 people, overwhelmingly civilians. The ceasefire stipulated that Israel would immediately ease the blockade imposed on the Strip and expand the fishing zone off Gaza's coast, but it has failed to do so. Continuing the Cairo brokered talks on the other side, key issues were repeatedly postponed in the wake of November attacks against Egyptian soldiers in the Sinai Peninsula. Israel has imposed a tightened blockade since 2007 after Hamas won the democratic legislative elections and took over the power on the Strip. Israeli Navy ships opened fire on Monday at dawn on a number of Palestinian fishing boats northwest of Gaza City. Eyewitnesses said one of the Navy ships chased the fishing boats while firing rounds of live ammunition, forcing the fishers back to the shore. The boats were within the 6 nautical miles allotted for the Palestinians for fishing. On Thursday morning, Navy ships attacked a number of Palestinian fishing boats, opened fire on them, and forced them back to shore. Last Wednesday morning, soldiers stationed across the border fence with the Gaza Strip opened fire at Palestinian fields east of Khan Yunis. And last Monday evening, the Navy opened fire on a fishing boat in Palestinian waters west of Gaza City, causing it to sink, and kidnapped 4 fishermen. The Israeli Navy targets Palestinian fishing boats on almost a daily basis in clear breach of the Egyptian-brokered truce agreement reached on August 26th of last year. The agreement includes allowing Palestinian fishermen to sail within 6 nautical miles in the Gaza Sea, with an incremental expansion in the allotted area. Under the Oslo Accords, the Palestinians are allowed to fish and sail within 20 nautical miles, but Israel kept attacking them and repeatedly, unilaterally reduced the miles to 3 and then to 6. Israeli forces have confiscated hundreds of dunams of Palestinian land in the Beit Ula town near Hebron. An Israeli court issued a confiscation order earlier in January to confiscate hundreds of dunams of land in the Al-Mekath Area C and empty it from its original residence. Owners of these lands have farmed them and resided on them since the Ottoman era. Israel was executing its plan to take over Area C, which is around 60% of the West Bank. The Hebron office of the Palestinian Prisoners Society has reported that Israeli soldiers kidnapped 120 Palestinians, including 2 young women and 25 children in Hebron, in the southern part of the occupied West Bank, in January. It added that most of the abductions were carried out by the military during late night hours, and that soldiers deliberately caused property damage while breaking into the homes and while violently searching them. The soldiers also assaulted families and frequently threatened them with physical harm during the invasion of their homes. One of the detainees, 16 years of age, said he was kidnapped during evening hours near the Al-Arub refugee camp after the soldiers attacked him, causing various fractures and bruises. The soldiers also attacked his brother and forced him onto the ground, causing him to bleed from his head, in addition to several cuts and bruises to different parts of his body. The Palestinian Society said among the kidnapped 120 Palestinians were 25 children who were mostly moved to the Etzion military base for interrogation and faced very difficult conditions, in addition to constant harassment and abuse. 16 of the kidnapped Palestinians are sick, require medical attention and follow-up, while 37 of the abducted have been forced under arbitrary administrative detention without charges or trial. 18 of the kidnapped Palestinians were moved to central interrogation centers, and most of them were beaten, assaulted, and tortured during interrogation. The Ofer Israeli military court also imposed fines on some of the kidnapped Palestinians, totaling more than 30,000 new Israeli shekels. Israeli soldiers opened fire in the direction of Palestinian protesters marching near the border fence in the Gaza Strip on Sunday. A spokesman for Gaza's Committee to Break the Siege told the Ma'an news service that the march was in protest over the continued Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and Israelis' refusal to allow reconstruction materials into Gaza. The anger in the streets of Gaza will soon explode in the face of those who besiege the Palestinian people, especially the Israeli occupation, said Abu Salima, referring to the eight-year-long blockade of Gaza imposed by Israel and Egypt. He accused Israel of delaying reconstruction of the war-torn coastal enclave in the wake of the Israeli assault this past summer, which saw the deaths of some 2,200 people, mostly civilians, and left nearly 110,000 homeless. Israeli forces on Thursday destroyed a water network which feeds Palestinian villages and Bedouin dwellings in the northern Jordan Valley. The head of the village council of Al-May and its surrounding Bedouin dwellings said. Mahan reported that Israeli troops escorted excavators which destroyed a 2,000-meter-long water pipe near the village of Al-Atuf. The pipeline, he said, was funded by the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committees. In addition, Israeli forces confiscated 250 meters of water pipes near the village of Yarza, east of Tubas. And as if things were not bad enough in Gaza, a UN agency said Tuesday it had to suspend an aid program for the Gaza war victims because of a shortfall of funding from donor countries. Robert Turner, head of the UN Relief and Works Agency in Gaza, said virtually none of the $5.4 billion pledged by the international community for post-war Gaza has reached the territory. This is distressing and unacceptable, he said. The agency said it needs $720 million to help 96,000 families from this group whose homes were damaged or abolished in the 2014 war. The agency pays for repairs of homes and rent subsidies. It has helped 66,000 families, but it said it ran out of money and faces a funding shortfall of $585 million. Gazans are desperate, and the international community cannot even provide the bare minimum. For example, a repaired home in winter, let alone a lifting of the blockade, access to markets, or freedom of movement, Turner said, referring to an Israeli-Egyptian border blockade imposed after the takeover of Gaza by the Islamic militant Hamas in 2007. Israel fought Hamas last summer to halt fire from Gaza. During the fighting, Israel launched thousands of airstrikes and artillery attacks, while Gaza militants fired thousands of rockets and mortar rounds. More than 2,200 Palestinians were killed, according to the UN. During the war, UN schools served as temporary shelters for tens of thousands of Gaza residents. Some 13,000 people remain in schools, including Sufayan Wadia, 36, whose 400-square-meter home was destroyed in the war. Wadia lives in a single classroom. A stove on a low wood table serves as a kitchen, and ragged cloth sheets cover the windows. We are in prison here, he said. This is not the life we should be living a year after the end of the war. And those were just a few news reports from this past week. Unfortunately, the reports next week will be no different. The feature presentation this week will be a continuation of our discussion on the legal assault against Palestinian rights activism we began last week by sharing the last two segments of the Institute of Palestine Studies conference held in Washington, D.C., which features civil rights attorney Yaman Salaha and Professor Stephen Saleta. As Palestinian voices grow in the United States, so have the attempts to silence those same voices. To counteract these assaults, we need to understand how Zionists work to keep the Palestinian narratives from the American public.
I'll be talking mostly about two legal initiatives related to this issue, but I want to start with a brief explanation of why the Asian Law Conference in San Francisco is involved in this issue. We're the oldest Asian American civil rights organization in the U.S., and we originally started getting involved in national security issues in the 80s when the organization filed a motion to overturn the conviction of Fred Korematsu, who's one of the Japanese American citizens detained during World War II, and his case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where he lost in one of the most infamous decisions in history. So after 9/11, the same organization became focused on the post 9/11 discrimination and impact on civil rights of Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian organizations. And based on what we've observed with respect to students and faculty on campuses, and the severe chilling effect that they face, not only when they speak about Israel and Palestine, but often on broader U.S. foreign policy issues in the Middle East, we see those two issues now under the First Amendment as one of the priority civil rights issues in the post 9/11 environment. And it's important to us, too, because many of the students who come from communities that face the brunt of U.S. foreign policy not only are facing an injustice there, but a second injustice altogether when they're robbed of their voices and their ability to draw attention to those issues. So a lot of what we talk about, Dima mentioned that so far many of these legal attacks have been unsuccessful, and that's really true in a strict formal legal sense. They haven't been found to be valid on their legal merits, but they have been successful in another way, which is in creating an environment in which anyone venturing into this area is worried about government investigation, even if it ultimately leads to no direct negative consequence. You have that entire period where nobody wants to be under investigation, right? So if there's anything you can do to avoid it, you will do that, and that often results in avoiding protected speech or expressing yourself on important issues. So one of the ways, one of the big issues under this comes under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is one of the most important civil rights statutes in the U.S., and it restricts recipients of federal funding from discriminating against people on the basis of race, color, or national origin in their use of that funds. Most institutions of higher learning in the U.S., both public and private, receive federal funding, so they're bound by this statute. And what has happened is that this process has been abused by a few organizations around the country who have cast really political objections to what pro-Palestinian student groups and faculty are saying on campus and cast it as a civil rights complaint. And it comes in under the language of a hostile environment. So if students are engaging in pro-Palestinian expression on campus, or if faculty departments are sponsoring panels or showing films on campus, all of a sudden you hear this claim that those acts on campus, that discourse on campus, creates a hostile environment for students in violation of their civil rights. This pattern actually traces back to 2004 when the first complaint was filed against UC Irvine, and then it was kind of put on hold, nothing much happened to it, but then there was a second wave of complaints starting in 2010, where UC Berkeley, UC Santa Cruz, Barnard College, Rutgers University, Columbia University all faced Title VI investigations by the U.S. Department of Education on these complaints. And I want to go into some detail about what these complaints actually consisted of, because I think it really makes clear that they're not civil rights issues at the end of the day. So in 2011, a UC Berkeley alumna sued the university alleging that it failed to mitigate a hostile environment against Jewish students on the basis of race, and she said that that environment was caused specifically by the Muslim Student Association and by Students for Justice in Palestine, who were described as organizations with pro-terrorist agendas, with links to Hamas, and every single group on the list that you can think of, even the ones that hate each other. And so the complaints themselves really self-consciously are invoking the broader anti-Arab and anti-Muslim environment in the U.S. to justify themselves. But here's what is actually written in her complaint filed with the court. So I'm switching it to third person. So she describes the frenzy, and she's describing what is a common tactic on campuses and mock military checkpoint, where students wear costumes and pretend to be Israeli soldiers, and some people play the part of Palestinian civilians crossing the checkpoint. And so she says she describes the frenzy of those military uniforms and people carrying realistic assault weapons. The soldiers holding realistic assault weapons and other participants shouted and yelled at passing students, "Prepare to be stopped, what is your religion?" The first time she was stopped, she was absolutely terrified. No one before had ever stopped her while carrying an assault rifle and yelling. She was ashamed and she was terrified for weeks. So this is the basis for the civil rights complaint against UC Berkeley. And when you read it, you really have to ask yourself, is this a Palestinian in the West Bank recording their experience at a checkpoint, or is it somebody talking about activism on campus? Right? So if this drama, which by the way is being misrepresented by out of all proportion, is so terrible, then surely the real thing must be much worse. But in fact, this is actually prototypical of the kinds of complaints that we're seeing around the country. And most of the time, actually pretty much all the time, we're not talking about bona fide hate speech on campus. We're not talking about a situation where there are student groups on campus, you know, spreading anti-Jewish slurs, spreading anti-Jewish stereotypes and themes, like stuff that no one would hesitate to describe as hate speech and anti-Semitic, but we're really talking about these traditional forms of activism and expression. So in the UC system and in California, you know, while this lawsuit was going on, while three UC campuses were under federal investigation based on similar complaints, you had a campus climate report published by the University of California system, which described, it basically blamed what it called the pro-Palestinian movement on campus for creating a hostile environment for Jewish students. It had many problems to go with it, but the examples of activity that created that hostile environment were things like describing Israeli policies as racist or apartheid and so on. And the California state legislature followed that with a resolution that passed unanimously and with no debate, describing the following statements as examples of anti-Semitism that should not receive any support on campus. So people shouldn't be allowed to use spaces on campus to make statements. Israel is a racist or apartheid state. That's the example. Israel is guilty of heinous crimes against humanity, such as ethnic cleansing and genocide. Those are the examples, right? So and this is actually an important issue, I think, for the movement in general here. The issue is not, are these claims true or false? That's one set of questions, right? Is it valid to hold this point of view? But a separate institutional question, which is, should universities permit other people to discuss the merits of those claims on campus? And so you kind of have to think about it and then start deploying two different arguments and two different discourses there. But it's a huge leap, regardless of whether you agree with the statements, it's a huge leap to saying that simply discussing those topics on campus creates a hostile environment for students. So with these complaints, and I'll get into some more specific examples of what kinds of activities were alleged to create these hostile environments later, but with these complaints, I think there are three major problems. I won't go into too much detail on two of them, but one is this false characterization of Jewish students as a monolithic whole who all feel one way about this issue and don't have diverse opinions between themselves. It just simply does not reflect the reality on campus, and that's something that has been voiced by a number of people who criticize these reports and investigations. But and two is that they, as I mentioned earlier, they totally misrepresent and hyperbolize what's going on campus. So these mock checkpoints, for example, in the language of the complaints, were analogized to passion plays in Europe, which is just like ludicrous. But the third that I think is most relevant for universities is this implication that people in a university setting should refrain from discussing issues if they upset the quote-unquote climate or if they make students feel somewhat uncomfortable. You know, so the language here of civil rights laws, which are meant to protect against racial and sexual harassment on campus, are hijacked in order to target political views and to silence a political debate. But it really raises the question, two things it does. It raises the question, the entire point of a protest is to disrupt the campus climate, right? Mm-hmm. Disrupt the climate in general, to raise attention to a problem with the status quo. But the second issue is, maybe I'll get to that in a minute. The second issue is if you're not going to discuss these issues on campus, where are you going to discuss this, right? So a lot of this has come in under the guise of civility. Earlier this year, UC Berkeley Chancellor released a statement, you know, espousing the virtues of civility on campuses, in which he says, when issues are inherently divisive, controversial, and capable of arousing strong feelings, the commitment to free speech and expression can lead to division and divisiveness that undermine a community's foundation. So in other words, divisive issues should not be discussed on campus, or we should tread carefully when doing so. And it just, it doesn't make sense as a rule for campus. Maybe for your Thanksgiving dinner next week, you avoid those hot button issues. But on campus, that's where you learn. You know, where else are students going to learn about divisive issues other than campus? Is it from television commentators? Well, that's not great analysis. You know, is it from politicians who have other interests aside from expressing their own feelings? They have to worry about voters, they have to worry about donors. It just totally turns on its head the point of the university. So I'll go into a couple more examples that Dima had mentioned, and then I'll shift to the more recent congressional issue related to funding Middle East Studies centers. But as Dima showed good examples of, the hostile climate discourse has been used against very, I would say, relatively mundane speech. So that banner at Barnard College, for example, the logic of the rhetoric against that was that it makes students feel unsafe as they're facing harassment and intimidation on campus, simply seeing that image. Those leaflets at Northeastern that led to expulsion, the same argument has been employed against those leaflets at Harvard, at NYU, at Yale, at Florida, at Atlantic University, University of Chicago. It's happened at so many different places. So one of the harms in this, it might seem petty, but one of the harms of this is that even when the complaints aren't legally meritorious, you have all these university administrators who don't want to face the prospect of a federal investigation because it harms their prestige. They don't want to face the prospect of losing federal funds, and so they overreact to student activism on campus and ends up stifling people's ability to discuss these issues. Shifting to the Higher Education Act. So Title VI of the Higher Education Act has been in place since the mid-50s, and it provides federal funding to various studies programs at universities around the country. And its purpose is to support U.S. Foreign interests by having people within this country who know about the rest of the world. And recently what we've seen is two organizations, one based here in D.C. called the Brandeis Center, and one in California called the UNCLA Initiative, have published reports claiming that these centers, the UNCLA Initiative, AMCHA, these reports, they claim that the academic centers are, quote, hostile to the United States, the West, and Israel, we're talking about Middle East studies in particular, that they are not, quote, unquote, not working as an effective pipeline to intelligence and national security agencies. And so they're calling upon Congress in the reauthorization cycle to add language that either defunds the centers altogether or gives power to the U.S. Department of Education, which disperses these funds, to review the content of academic programs to ensure that they have balanced perspectives, meaning a more, rather than having scholars who are writing based on what they see as an accurate view of the situation, scholars are trying to get a quota, pro, quote unquote pro, whatever that means, Israel, and quote unquote, well, they don't want the second one. But in their reports, the best precedent that they cite for this is an effort by President Nixon to defund foreign area studies in the 70s, as a result of academics who opposed the Vietnam War. So it's really clear that it's political motivation here. But the suggestions are also radically at odds with First Amendment rights that have been clearly established because of those repression tactics that were used in the 50s, 60s, and 70s against the emerging civil rights movement. So there's a lot of Supreme Court rhetoric that we can tap into in mobilization efforts against these programs that work quite well into our favor on these issues, talking about how the exclusion of governmental intervention in the intellectual life of the university is necessary to preserve free universities. And it doesn't matter whether that intervention is avowed or to action that inevitably tends to check the ardor and fearlessness of scholars. But as a lot of people in Middle East studies, especially those that aren't tenured or are still graduate students, you don't want to study a number of issues because people tell you you're not viable if you do that. And then the last thing I'll note is that the factual basis for these calls is just totally grossly distorts what's actually happening. So the main focal point of the most recent calls is UCLA Center for Near East Studies against which a report was published 2 months ago claiming that 93% of their events exhibit a quote-unquote anti-Israel bias, and 75% reflect anti-Semitism. UCLA has published its own rebuttal, which is quite good, but you can guess the usual problems with the report. Their definition of bias being so broad it includes events co-hosted by J Street, by J Street on campus. Their definition of anti-Semitism being so broad that it includes the following statement. They actually have an appendix of examples, and includes a speaker stated that Israel was created through colonialism. That is an anti-Semitic statement. And then the lack of perspective. So I think it's helpful to bring these other issues in as well. But when we focus only on this within the parameters of Israel and Palestine, we lose sight of the broader, you know, implications of this, which make no sense in any other context. So by suggesting that there's a disproportionate critical focus on Israel, they are suggesting that Middle East scholars in general love the other governments in the Middle East as if they're not critical of those as well, right? So just a listing of those events at UCLA, for example, stopping the nuclear threat from Iran, Egypt, stillborn revolution, they don't sound like pro-government events. So I will leave the rest for a question. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for those who organized the event and for those of you who attended. I feel like I don't have much to comment on. I'm following behind three terrific presentations. So I was thinking about some things as the others spoke before me. Some observations that come to mind that I hope will transition to a few points about my own situation with the University of Illinois. Andrew sort of mentioned about the pretext of Rasmia lying on her immigration application and how of course it's tendentious, who the government chooses to go after in the first place in such cases. You know, the government prosecuted and deported everybody who lied on their immigration papers. You know, like, the population of this country would be, like, 10 million. You know, like, this is, you know, they really, you know, it's a matter of choosing to find a pretext to oust somebody in the first place, and then some matter of illegal activity always comes after, right? So it's always the witch hunt that precedes the illegal activity or the supposed illegal activity. It's remarkable to me that how sophisticated and effective Palestine activism is on campus these days, and how wonderful and intelligent the students are who organize it and participate in it. But it's likewise remarkable to me that those students often need lawyers, organizing around a particular policy issue of interest to them often results in criminalization, and that's a deeply troublesome phenomenon. But when it happens to a place like Loyola Chicago, and when they end up on probation for a year, there are lots of responses we can have to it that might be productive. But one that comes to mind for me is I was setting up an event with them, for next semester, and they wrote me and told me that they don't have funding, and that they won't be able to do it. And so, I wrote back and said, well, I'll do the event for free. I'll arrange travel by other means. I'll come to campus. Their professors can reserve the classroom space, right? And they can hold their events as planned. So maybe when an SJP chapter gets shut down, we can some level of critical mass perhaps continue to organize events on campus, right, to at least keep the movements going and sort of pitch in that way as a showing of support and of course as a showing of defiance against overbearing administrators. And then it also when Yaman talks about the types of activism that are being suppressed on campus, a lot of them are really creative. I feel like Palestinian students lining up to sign up for Birthright is particularly clever, right? So a lot of the things that they do, the Zionists don't simply want to disrupt our politics. We have to keep that in mind. They also want to shut down our imagination, right? They want to shut down the creative, clever ways in which we come into engagement with a certain sort of politics. It's part of a broader process of I think these institutions, wanting us all to become corporate automatons, right? They want us to be unthinking subjects. They want us to be incapable of thinking about novel and interesting ways to challenge conventions of thought and law and politics and so forth. It all goes back to an appeal to authority on the part of Zionist activists or pro-Israel activists, if you will, on campus. Where they are unable to defend Israel in the public arena, and it's my contention, I think a lot of people's contention, that Israel is becoming more and more difficult to defend, and I'll speak about that in just a second, they end up relying on punitive modes of authority to prevent the conversation or the debate from happening in the first place. So it's important to keep our activism and our work in conversation, right, with discourses and philosophies that reject the exercise of state power through laws, policing, surveillance, and so forth. We can't, in other words, just be reliant on forms of institutional authority to proffer or provide justice, because it's often those sites of authority where injustice is institutionalized and practiced. When I say that Israel is becoming increasingly difficult to defend, I'm drawing my cue really from what I hear Israel's ostensible defenders saying recently. During the wide-ranging debate that we had, that many of us conducted around the ASA boycott resolution, which was around exactly a year ago, right, around exactly, which was a year ago. I noticed that opponents of the resolution weren't actually defending Israel, or they weren't deigning to defend Israel. They were simply opposing boycotts and what they conceptualized as some matter of principle, right? That it singles Israel out, right? That's the one that we've all heard a million times, right? I find that a particularly annoying argument, not only because it's so stupid, but because, Israel has worked hard for decades to make itself sound exceptional, right? And then it has the audacity to say, you're singling this out. You singled yourself out. We ever dreamed of doing such a thing, right? You're the one that told us you're aligned to the nations and better than everybody else, and that you represent a higher standard of morality. Leaving that as a rant over, slash our hashtag rant over. They were also saying, why don't you boycott North Korea? What about China? Nothing makes a Zionist more compassionate about the suffering of people in Tibet and North Korea than criticism of Israel, right? That really tugs at their heartstrings. But nobody was saying, or very few people were saying, the claims that pro-BDS folks are making about Israel are false. They weren't actually defending Israel, or they were defending Israel in sort of a roundabout way by not actually defending what Israel does. Right? he's also during Operation Protective Edge. I saw very little, although I did see some, but I saw very little pro-Israel argument saying that what Israel was being accused of wasn't happening. You know, most of them would grudgingly acknowledge that children were being killed by the dozen, that UN shelters were being bombed, that hospitals were being bombed, that schools were being bombed, that the population was suffering. The population of Gaza was suffering tremendously, right? That really wasn't in much contest, right? They weren't merely blaming it on the Palestinians. Like they were saying, well, it's Hamas's fault that the Palestinians are suffering so much. Or the old colonial trope that the Palestinians are making this act in such a way. So, yes, there's violence, but that violence is not our responsibility. It's the responsibility of the Palestinians. And it's a terrible argument, morally, intellectually, you know, in every way you can think of. But the point is, there was no real defense, right, of the behavior of Israel. There was merely an outsourcing of the responsibility for that behavior. So Israel is becoming more and more difficult to defend, right? And so sort of tactics, which as I think Yaman and Dima did a great job of pointing out, can become hysterical, right? In some cases, begin to rely on sites of institutional authority to intervene where an honest intellectual argument stands no chance. This is, a final point then, because my time is running out, and I'm sure your patience as well. I think it's important to think about my context with the University of Illinois, where I was hired in an American Indian Studies program. And I was hired in that program in part because they were interested in sort of conceptualizing Palestine as an indigenous space, or as a space that can be in conversation, right, with other colonized communities around the world, in North America particularly. And so I think it's important to locate these problems that Andrew and Dima and Yaman, have raised about overzealous policing, overzealous prosecution, state repression, etc. We can locate these problems not just as a form of suppression of Palestine solidarity activists, but in the specific framework of American oppression, right? So it was the folks in Chicago who conducted a fishing expedition against Vesmia, right? Well, it's also in Chicago where the police, shot Fred Hampton dead, while he was sleeping, right? There are these modes of domestic repression that have been going on for a very long time, and so I believe that it's useful to keep thinking about these Zionist tactics that seem newfangled are actually part of a very long process of policing quote-unquote radical communities in the United States, even though not all Palestine solidarity work is actually radical, right? Some of it is just Palestine solidarity work, but of course, according to the standards of the normative, that work is inherently or necessarily radical, right? And then I guess just as a closing thought, in regard to the kind of fear that ensues because of these sorts of tactics. I think it's deeply important for anybody who wants to be active in issues around Palestine and decolonization to take a close assessment of their own personal circumstances, their own career goals, etc., and understand that some sort of recrimination is always possible, and you weigh your options accordingly, but you don't stop yourself from being active in something that is profoundly important for you to be active in, right? The choice in the end is a personal one, right? But if you feel like it's something that you want to do, that's important for you to take up, then I don't think that you should let your fear necessarily stop you. You can always find creative ways of being involved without necessarily being public, if that makes sense, right? And I think my case has shown, and Rasmia's and others, that there is a tremendous unity despite many political differences, right, that gets generated around egregious cases of harassment or prosecution or whatever the case may be, that we have the ability in critical mass to stand together, right, and to try our best as a community to make sure that this sort of nonsense doesn't continue happening in the future. Because for me, as long as the Palestinians, on whose behalf we work, suffer tremendous violence and suppression, as long as they continue to hold their heads high and endure, I think that we have to do the same thing. Thank you.
That was Yamin Salahi and Stephen Saleta speaking at the Conference on the Legal Assault Against Palestinian Rights Activism, sponsored by the Institute of Palestine Studies. In closing, I would like to read an article published in Mondo Weiss by Samer Jaber, who currently lives in Bethlehem. While Samer was living in Cambridge and studying for his master's degree at Brandeis University and the Kennedy School of Government a few years back, he co-hosted this radio program with me. Samer is a political activist and researcher and is the managing director for Dar El Karma Incorporated for media, research, and publication. He writes this touching memorial for his friend, Abed Kolkot. After 7 years of negotiation between Palestinians and Israelis and 5 years of an interim agreement, Abed Kolkot, an ordinary Palestinian citizen who lived his entire life in Dahesa refugee camp, decided to leave this vastly overcrowded area. He moved to a piece of land he inherited from his family, located in an area occupied in June 1967 and designated as Area C according to the Interim Peace Accord. Area C comprises 60% of the West Bank in the occupied Palestinian territories, and it is land that Israel retains full security and administration over. Abed's piece of land is located in front of Al-Walaja village, Abed's original hometown that was displaced and destroyed during the Nakba in 1948. Abed's land, from the Israeli point of view, is located between three communities, Har Gilo and Gilo, located in the West Bank area, and Maha, in West Jerusalem. The Israeli occupied authority did not give him a building permit to build a shelter, so he decided to live in an old cave. Though the area where Abed settled is part of a Palestinian town called Bet Jala and remaining part of Al-Walaja, Palestinians usually need permission from the Israeli Army branch called Israel Civil Administration to work the land. In Abed's case, the Jerusalem municipality intervened under the pretext that the area is part of Jerusalem's master plan. The Jerusalem municipality, which is a Jewish Israeli entity, asked Abed to move out of his parcel since he does not hold a Jerusalem residency. Abed refused and petitioned the municipality's decision in front of an Israeli court. During that period, the court was hearing the case, Abed was ordered by the judge not to change the status quo. The status quo means he can't do anything in his land, while for Jerusalem municipality, it is business as usual. Nevertheless, Abed started to reclaim his land by planting it with olive trees, a permaculture garden, and added an outdoor bathroom and awning in front of the cave. Because he was not able to use tractors and machines, Abed resorted to instruments like shovels and axes. And because he was not allowed to dig a well, he has to bring water in by gallons from far away. Israeli police warned Abed multiple times for him to desist from his work. He kept telling them sarcastically, "If you want to take the land, take it planted with trees." Jewish settlers from the surrounding colonies threatened him by unleashing their dogs on him and many other harassment methods. After more than a decade in the court, and after the Jerusalem municipality started developing the area by establishing a park and the government announced a settlement expansion, the verdict came out. The court verdict stated that Abed can stay in his cave but cannot alter the land, which means no water, no electricity, and no safe passage. As a consequence of the court verdict, the police and municipality demolished the bathroom, the awning, and destroyed his garden. Abed became sick after this experience. However, he decided to rebuild the demolished structures. With the help of his local and international friends, he managed to rebuild part of the demolished structures after 3 months. However, the municipality and police raided the place and demolished it again without any warning and without a court order. Abed again became sick. He was admitted to a hospital, suffering from asphyxia, and passed away. He was 54 years old when he died and spent 14 years of them fighting Israeli colonization in the courts by remaining steadfast in his land. A friend of Abed's visited him one day before he passed away. Abed told him that he wanted to go back to his land to rebuild it again. His physical strength failed, but his dream did not. His progeny also wants to return to the land. That was a memoriam written by Samer Jaber from Bethlehem and published in Mondo Weiss. Yet another courageous story of Palestinian resistance to the colonization of the West Bank. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next week. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.